Welcome to Business Insights. I would like to thank you for tuning in. There's a lot of content out there, so you spending this hour with us means a great deal. This show is my opportunity to share the entrepreneurial success stories of our local business owners, and I encourage you to join me each week as we profile a new member of our business community. Bill Patchett is an entrepreneur and philanthropist. Bill had very humble beginnings, leaving school at an early age to help out at home. Through years of hard work, dedication, and applying a real go-getter attitude, Bill took his job as a stock boy and grew it into ownership over a chain of grocery stores. Success provided opportunity for Bill to give back. He became very active in Rotary and other important community causes, including the building of and ongoing funding for our hospital. Please enjoy my conversation with Bill Patchett, first looking at his upbringing and his introduction to the grocery business. My guest today, Bill Patchett. I'm gonna pass it over to you now, Bill. You were born and raised in Toronto. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Toronto.
Okay, I was born and raised on Atlas Avenue. And then when I was very young, then we moved to Dynevor Avenue. And I have five of my family and one brother and five sisters. And every one of us, because there was no money in those days, all of us had to quit school to help my parents. I left school in my second grade of high school at the age of 14. I had to get a permit to get out. So my first job, and let's start, go back a bit further. My first job was helping a gentleman sell Christmas trees up the road, and he promised me 50 cents for every tree I sold and 50 cents for every tree I got rid of. Well, I sold 50 trees and there was about 20 trees left. Well, he never paid me, but I learned the lesson is get your money first and then you're okay. But what I did do was return all the Christmas trees back to the location because I had taken them all down to my parents' house and put them in the backyard. For that, I got a hot seat. So that's when I decided back they all went. So I got even a little bit. After that, I had a paper route for 2 years. And from my paper route, I started to deliver for the drugstores. And from the drugstores, I went to a hardware, Gord's Hardware, Duff & Nagleton, and fantastic people. They were very messy in the basement. So I asked if I could clean it up, and they said yes. So in an apron that's been down there probably 2 years was $350. So I returned it, and they couldn't believe it. And after that, they would let me handle the cash. I looked after the store after it was closed. And then from there, there was Power Supermarkets at Bathurst and Nathan was looking for help. And remember, I was just 14 years old, so I applied for a part-time job. They were all gone except for garbage boy. And I threw up my hand right away and I said, I'll take it. And that meant that I had to take all the garbage throughout the whole store, pack it up in boxes. And then when the truck came, I had to push it up a chute and somebody would be there to get it. So that went on for a couple of months. And I asked the store manager, it was Scotty McKenzie, I remember dearly. And I said to the store manager, can I clean up your basement? Because it was a mess. It was all in disorder. So they said, yeah. So after 2 or 3 weeks, I got it all cleaned up and I put everything in the basement, alphabetical order, so they could order properly. Well, that was a cat's meow.
Wow.
A couple of weeks after that, they offered me a full-time job and I took it. So $28 a week.
Let me ask you this. So you realize that the family needs some support.
Oh, absolutely.
You go out and start finding all of these jobs.
That's right.
You obviously have a knack for wanting to organize things.
Yes. Oh, I do. I like to be well organized. And all the money I made went to my parents to pay for the house and the food and everything. But I had a great time when I was young.
So you were moved into the kind of the grocery store scene.
Yes.
That obviously led to a major impactful career in the grocery world. You were 14 years old. You move up into a full-time position.
Yes.
Where do you really go from there? What really sparked the next?
Just getting that job started me in the food business for my entire life. So I was a grocery clerk for a couple of years. And then they offered me assistant manager's job, so they sent me around to 3 or 4 stores. And then when I got close to 20, I asked the supervisor, how can I become a store manager? And in those days, and this is silly, you were either 20 or 21, married, or you were more than, and you were quite mature. I solved that problem. My wife and I got married right away. And they made me a store manager right away. And my first one was Queen Leslie. And then I went from store to store, and I moved up further. And then they made me a supervisor. And by the time I was 25, they put me in store operations for 59 stores. But then, just before I was 30, my store managers, some of them were leaving, and I asked them why. They were buying these IGA stores, Mom and Pa. Well, they're making $200,000, $250,000 a year 50 years ago.
Right.
So I quit, and I bought my first store at Kerr Street, Oakville. And as luck had it, because I knew the map of everything about Loblaws, that the store up the road was going to close. Well, that store in Oakville was 4,000 square feet doing $4,000 in business. 2 months later, I was doing $36,000 a week.
Wow.
And I never looked back. That's a lot of money in those years. And so I bought up to 6 stores, and I always had a garden center. And then I sold everything, and I thought I would get into something else, but there was nothing there. So then I bought the store at the end of my street, a Mom and Pa store. And that was the same thing. Wasn't doing much, but I talked the landlord to putting a little dish in on it, and I opened up Sundays, so my sales went, so I never looked back from then. And then I bought another one up till I got 5 stores, and that's when I was looking for another one, and I was talking to Dominion then, and they had the Dominion store in Colebrook here, and it was the highest money maker in the whole organization. But they wanted my head signs. By the saying head signs, that I turned the stores over to them, and if they sold them, the Dominion would control them.
Okay.
So that's what I did. So that's pretty well the food industry.
You're in a very good job when you were working.
Oh, yes,
in
I was.
There, and you obviously noticed more people finding another way to make a good revenue stream. Well, so how did you start when you owned your first store? I think people would be very interested to know what that was like. You had to work through some sort of financing. You had to work through that process.
Well, my first store, I think I paid about, I don't know, maybe $15,000 for it, which was a lot of money. And about a year later, I had that paid off. And from there on in, I didn't look back because the sales went up and I had the garden center. And my garden centers always made more profit than the stores.
Right.
That's why I put them in all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So the garden center was an addition. Were many other stores doing that?
No, I was the only one.
Yeah. Okay. It's now a normal feature in most grocery stores today.
You know, they're all doing it today. And one of the interesting things is that when I was on the road, Bradford Greenhouses had a little garden center twice the size of this house. And I got to know them very well. And I was the first one to sell vegetables and flowers at the front of the store. Nobody else did. So I started that, and it wasn't long before the company had 2 or 3 dozen doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I did when I was in operation is I got Bradford listed in Loblaw. And today, they do millions and millions of dollars in business. And they look after me with my mums. They give me a good price and good quality.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to pay them till the end. But they've been absolutely wonderful.
So can you just tell us, what was it like? Now, green grocers were a big thing.
Yes. Mr. Grocer.
Mr. Grocer.
Yeah.
How would you say the evolution of the grocery store from when you were first starting at 14, really, until when you kind of more or less...
It changed immensely because in those days you used to have to write the order on a card and then you had to send that card into Loblaw and they would send your groceries out to you. That took a lot. Today, they don't have to do anything because they just put the wand across it and the wand tells them how much they need.
Mm-hmm.
So that changed immensely. In my day, you paid the employees. You had one of the financial people looked after it Today, the wages are all done automatically. The store manager doesn't have to do any wages. He doesn't have to do any ordering. The store manager's day is basically is to be on the floor, say hello to people, and that's it. Goodwill. Right. It's changed immensely.
So you told me about a story quickly when we were speaking on the phone about how you had some adversity when you first started because you had a few armed robberies.
Well, I had five armed robberies I went through, and that was at Finch and Bathurst, and I lived just up the road, and of course, I would close that store myself. The rest of the stores, I had managers close them. So we went through five armed robberies. One was where I recognized the voice. Lived around the corner. They apprehended him. The next one was three university kids, well-educated, in London, Ontario, and the parents were very wealthy. In 2 weeks, they had pulled off 18 armed robberies. I followed them in my car, and every time he put the gun to me, I would just duck. That was stupid. So I ended up eventually catching up to him, and I hit his leg, and he fell down. The police came and captured him and said, Bill, remember, you're in fear of your life. So I did. Mm-hmm. And so all three of them went to jail. And it was a shame because they were so bright. What a silly way to ruin your life. Mm-hmm. Another one came in. They all came in with shotguns or gun. Another one came in with balaclavas on. And the police were doing a spot check 3 or 4 months later. They found the balaclavas in their car. And they came to me, and sure enough, they were arrested. There's a couple other there.
It's very fascinating. I guess some things you don't think about when you get into the grocery business is that you're going to be having to handle not just the running and the operations, but serious moments like that where people can be...
Well, I was young enough and stupid enough in those days that didn't bother me because I had no fear of anything. And the police gave me a citation, the police chief of Toronto. So that was kind of nice. So, yes, we apprehended all five of them. And I was delighted.
Again, in the grocery business, you're building this grocery empire. You also have an affinity for something else, for horse racing.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
My wife won't agree with me, but I've been doing it for 55 years. And I've got to know every horse, every trainer, every owner. Some I met, others I just study up, so I know what's going on with them. And I go once a week. Somebody will take me, and I have a great time, and I'll bet a few horses for the one that takes me, and I always make sure they win at least $200 or $300 for the day. But yeah, I enjoy it, and I'm not going to stop because it's the only thing I've spent money on. I've never golfed, nothing, just that, and I'm not going to stop, I told my wife. So she's kind of accepted it.
You know? So I guess back then you used to get information. Do you get information about the horses and all kinds of different mediums?
Well, I do. I go to Whitby, and they're very good to me. They got a parking spot for me. They buy my lunch, and whoever takes me, they buy their lunch. And all the forms that are $5, they supply them. They make 10%. Right. And people got to realize that I might be betting a few dollars, but I'm getting a few dollars back. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's really a lot by the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I really like it.
During your growth in your career, there was a lot of grocery chains and a lot of grocery stores that were making big headlines. Was there anybody that you looked to specifically for inspiration about how to grow your business and different things like
that? Well, the man that moved me forward was Leon Weinstein, who owned Power Supermarkets. And then sold it to Loblaw, and then Loblaw came in control. But he was the one that promoted me all the way up. He liked me, and he wouldn't let anybody pick on me. And in those days, the new stores, I would do all the ordering, all the hiring. I would do the layout of the stores and order all the what shelving we need. You did actually everything. Mm-hmm. But he was a strong supporter of mine. Just fabulous man.
Fantastic. I think it's really important to have those people
absolutely.
To help guide your career and lead some level of inspiration.
And I had others during my life that were very good that I worked with and I got along well with.
Fantastic. So you're sold up your interest. You've made a migration to Cobourg. What led to the migration to Cobourg?
Well, I was looking for another store for my son and IGA didn't have any available. But that's during the time that Loblaw was getting involved with Dominion Stores, vice versa. And I said to him, I want another store. So as I said earlier, if I gave them the head sign, they would give me the pick up whatever I wanted. So I looked at the master sheets, and Kohlberg was making more money than any other store.
Right.
So I took it.
So we're speaking with Bill Patchett. He's a local community builder and philanthropist. We're just talking about his early days in business, and he's shedding a lot of insights on what he's done to accomplish his success. We'll be back after this break.
We are chatting with entrepreneur and philanthropist Bill Patchett today on Business Insights with John Racine. Before we discuss Bill's introduction to Kohlberg, Bill recounts an interesting story about how an outside influence disrupted his business.
Another thing I had when I was in Curve Street, Oakville, I was selling wine grapes to the Italians and the Portuguese, and the Italian boys even threatened my buyer that they would blow up the store. That didn't bother me. I didn't pay any attention to them. So I did it for about 5 years, and I did very well with it. And then the sixth year, they decided, and they all got together, they cut the cost of a lug of grapes from $10 to $5. I had about probably $500,000 sitting on the parking lots. And so I got out of it, and I had to sell one of my stores to pay off my debt because I didn't want to go in debt.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a fantastic insight because certainly growth is fantastic, but at the same time, there could be an outside influence
that's
that could very much disrupt it.
All the things that happen, you know, during a lifetime, it's amazing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And a lot of the things I've done, I've forgotten, you know. But I've had a good time, and I can tell you the people in Kohlberg are fantastic.
Certainly.
They support everything I've done.
So talking about Kohlberg, you find this location, you decide to move out here.
Yes, we did.
You decide to move out here, I believe from my research, that was 1988?
That is correct.
So 1988, you decide to move out to Kohlberg. You have a family at that moment. How old are the kids?
Families. Oh, my kids weren't very old. When I came out here, my son was probably 22, 23.
Sure.
They're all younger.
Yep.
But now they're all in their 50s, so they're getting on.
So you open the store, but you, from reading through your CV, I noticed you joined Rotary right away.
Oh, I did. And it's the best thing I did because I learned how to public speak, whether it's 500 or 1,000 a room. I try to memorize everything so I don't use a note. When I use notes, it doesn't work, so I memorize everything. They taught me, I can say, to how to promote, how to speak, all kinds of things. That was an asset to me, and especially fundraising, because I got involved in that about 2 years after being in Rotary. I've been in 32 years. I've done polio for Canada. I still do it, but I'm not a chair anymore. I've done fundraising, which I'm still doing, from 10,000 to a quarter million. 2 years ago, I brought in seven people, so that was 350,000. It's amazing the amount of people that will come forward. So I do that, and, well, different things. I've been on every committee in Rotary. I'm a past governor. I went around to all the clubs, and I never had any trouble getting support from any of them. It's amazing.
So Kohlberg Rotary Club is a very strong...
It's one of the strongest in our district. Toronto Club has more members than us, not many, and then we're second. But our club raises over a quarter million every year that goes right back into the community.
It's a fantastic organization. You have some great members, Dr. Bob Scott, of course, who's had major influence in our quest to eradicate polio.
Yes.
But you have just a really strong foundation in the community.
And that's because the majority of them get involved. The older ones, as they get up to 80, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But all the young ones get involved, and some of the little older members. And whatever we do, we have enough people to help us.
Here's a question, and I think everybody would love to hear the answers that go around this. You're obviously very famous for raising money for great causes.
Well, remember, though, I couldn't do it unless I have a team.
Absolutely.
And they're the ones that make it happen. I tell people that all the time. all I do is a little push. Well, maybe I do a big push, and that's all I do just to get them on board.
Well, you have obviously some great management skills because you've gotten more people on board to help you do this. When did you, was there an aha moment where you said, actually, I think I can raise more money, or I think that I'll be good at this?
I grew into it when I first got involved with Bob Scott at the beginning with polio, and then I started with the foundation in our district, and it just grew from there. And I've never had any trouble asking people for money. I'm not shy.
Sure.
And if somebody says no, I'll go back a month later and ask them again and again. A lot of people can't do that. They're shy. Mm-hmm. And if you end up, we have 150 members of our club. We might have 10 that can do a good job, and all the rest are shy.
It's a personality-driven
thing. Yes, it is.
You know where to potentially find the money, and do you use some of the experience you had in business to be able to read people, to be able to communicate clearly that their support is going to be very
absolutely
valuable?
I never ask anybody for money. I always research if they can't afford it because I think that's unfair. But if you have money, look out, I'm coming after you.
Sure.
And that's been my philosophy my whole life.
Now, you're not the champion of one cause or a single cause. You're a champion of many causes.
I've sat on pretty well every nonprofit organization in town, almost. I did United Way for 3 years, and, you know, Rotary I've done for years, and I did community living. I did them all. Mm-hmm. And I'd stay on for maybe 2 years, and because I want to give somebody else the chance. But during that 2 years, I try to give them as many ideas and suggestions and bring a lot of creativity into it so that they continue.
We're speaking with Bill Patchett, a local community builder and philanthropist. So, Bill, you said you give these organizations that you sit on the time and effort, but also some tips and some ideas about what you think is going to help either propel them forward. Mostly in the fundraising perspective, what would you say are some of the essential components about raising money?
Well, the first thing, when if I become part of a board, I make sure that they have a meeting at least once a month and that they communicate so the left hand knows what the right hand's doing. That's very important. And then I'll give them a lot of ideas on how to raise money, simple ones. For instance, one of them I'm going to try here. And you got to always look for something. When we were in PEI in North Rustico, we noticed that Canada Day, there was hundreds of thousands of flags. Every home had 50 to 100 flags on it. They were little wee ones that stuck in the ground. So I went to the town hall, found out where they got them, and they said they were giving them to them free. And I said to, and I'm the chair of Children's Foundation, so I passed it on to the lady I answered to, and so we're going to do it next year. And I think I can get them for about 3 cents, and we'll sell them for 10 or 15 cents. We'll easily make $10,000. But
right.
That's the kind of things I look for. We're going to, for the Children's Foundation, we have a motorcycle ride. I've got about $250. We're going to do that next year. It's too late this year. And we have our gala dinner coming up. They call the Great Crush. We're hoping that will bring in about $25,000. Every little idea you help, you've just got to bring it to fruition, and things will happen.
You can come in and you can assess what's going on currently in an organization.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you're there because where your real strengths lie is in leadership and in raising money. Is there a personal story or a personal touch that you think is essential into getting people involved?
Oh, there's so many, really. I think the key to it is when they ask you to come in, as I said earlier, and that's making sure you got the right team and they know in which direction they're going. If they don't know in which direction they're going, then you're in trouble. And that we have lots of meetings. And I try to get people that aren't afraid to fundraise and have a lot of creativity. So then we can start to put ideas together.
Fantastic. You're now in the community. You've joined the Rotary Club. You've been a part of really an endless amount of organizations to help raise awareness, raise some money. When do you decide to potentially walk away from the grocery business?
Oh, 10 years ago, and we had a lot of stuff here and there. And I was in fear that if I died, my wife would have a difficult time looking after it. And we agreed that it was time to get rid of everything. So we sold everything. Mm-hmm. And it was only a few years after that I got sick. So it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. You know. So you didn't just focus in on grow trees, but you were also part of the town of Coburg in a big way as far as real estate goes.
Oh, yeah.
What's the motivation behind your real estate portfolio?
Well, the store I had at the mall, and it was my wife's idea to buy the grocery store. Mm-hmm. So I didn't tell her. I bought the whole mall. And when I got home, she said, "I just a grocery store." I said, "Well, it was a good deal." And I went to the bank, and I said, "I need a little bit of money here." And it was done on a handshake. That wouldn't happen today.
It's hard to believe it would happen today, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So it's commercial real estate.
I had a few homes that I rented out, and I had quite a few businesses here and there, and I had a lot of land on the waterfront. But as soon as we sold everything.
So you liquidated all that. Yeah. Would you say it's important to own the building you operate in?
Oh, I tell my children, buy a house because it's going to triple by the time you get 50. My success came when I sold my stores. I bought property. All I can say is you can't go wrong.
Right.
Property's gone up so much.
Welcome back to Business Insights with John Racine. Please join us for the conclusion of our conversation with entrepreneur and philanthropist Bill Patchett.
You're now a revered individual in the fundraising community. What would you say is an essential process for somebody new starting out, somebody who's probably younger in their own business or younger in their career, who's looking to get into philanthropic activities?
First of all, one has to be in the position to do it. My wife and I have been fortunate enough that we can support this one and that one. That's important, because if you didn't have that, I wouldn't be where I am today. Mm-hmm. So money's the key to everything. But for somebody new coming on, I would always suggest them buy property. Play the market. The market's been very good, but you really got to know what you're doing there. I've been part of Rob Day's program that he started many years ago. I was the first one, and that was helping all the new merchants in town to be successful. So we had about 10 volunteers then, and I had, I think, 3 or 4 stores, and one of them in town is the human being, Mark. And at the beginning, I told him what, and he did everything I told him, and he has a fantastic business now. Another one had a meat market and grocery store in town, but they were closed at 5 o'clock and they weren't open Sundays, and they were on the harbor, and that's when all the people came in. Mm-hmm. But they ended up losing their business.
Right.
But they wouldn't listen.
You see all kinds of different businesses, yes, and operations in a small community. Some thrive, some mm-hmm. maybe have some stalled growth, or there's something that they need to potentially change.
That's where we would come into the picture, myself. I would look after ones I knew, like the restaurant business and the grocery business, that sort of thing. If anybody was into something else and they needed an engineer, we had an engineer there. We had somebody in construction there. But we would work together as a team, coming up with ideas and suggestions to help that individual.
That's a fantastic program.
And that's what made it work. And Rob Day's done a fabulous job, and he's still there today.
Wow.
Doing a great job.
So I want to quickly talk about the hospital.
Uh-huh.
The hospital needed a lot of money in order for it to be built.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that challenge and how you tackled raising that money.
Well, I was the chair of it. And then I had Bob McCooby help me, who did a great job, and a few others. And I simply went out and asked people to give either $10,000, $50,000, or $100,000. And I just kept after them, and they all came through. It wasn't hard. And within a year and a half, we had it all paid for. From there on, and I continued on the foundation board, and there's Rhonda runs it, but there's basically only 2 of us doing the fundraising. That's Jim Mills and myself. But the board is very good. They're not the people that can ask for money, but they come up with great ideas and suggestions, and they'll bring a lot of strength into it. So they make a huge difference.
Healthcare costs have obviously are always a concern, especially for a small community like Cobourg, Port Hope, Northumberland area. How do you look at it as far as sustainability? Our annual costs are very high. The community needs to support it. What do you say about the sustainability fundraising?
That's a good question. And the success of that is if we can find a way to look after all these new people that are coming in town. And I think we increased 2% of the senior citizens. We're now 52. And this year, I won't be surprised to see it go 53 or 54. That's putting a tremendous pressure on our hospital.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Okay?
So they come here, and it costs a lot of money. So that's why we try to keep it up with far as the equipment. When fundraising, the operating the hospital isn't our responsibility. It's up to the foundation board. It's their responsibility to come up with ideas, suggestions, a little creativity on how they can raise money through the governments. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's how they do it and get the governments. And they did recently. They gave quite a bit, and that made a difference. But it's going to be very hard. 10, 15 years from now, I'm telling my children that, first of all, you might not have the support from the hospital and all these benefits when you're sick. I said, that's going to be very scarce. As far as the pensions and all that, that in maybe 10 or 15 years, I believe a lot of that's going to disappear because they're not going to have the money.
Right.
So I'm encouraging them to put money away. And it's going to happen. It's inevitable.
Sure. You're involved in raising this money, raising awareness. Currently, right now, you're selling mums, flowers.
Yes.
And you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation here, you've been through three transport truckloads worth of mums, which is fantastic. How do you get the word out? Is it just word of mouth?
Or how do you... Everybody knows for years I've been doing it for about 15 or 16 years. When I first started, nobody did it in Cobourg except me, but they learned quickly, let me tell you. Of course, that ain't into our profit. But we have signs up. We have the radio supporting us for free. We have the newspaper doing full ads for free. We talk it up. I announce it at Rotary. I go to the retirement homes, the two of them here. And, well, I went to all the merchants downtown, and they all bought a couple. I just keep asking different organizations, different people, and it pays off.
Selling the mums goes towards a very worthy
cause.
Mental
health and the hospital. Now, what the hospital sells, they get completely, and they've been doing a great job. But what we raise where we're sitting across from No Frills, that goes to mental health. And when Dr. Michelle Long called me, and she said, look, Bill, she said, nothing's been done with mental health. And she started to explain to me how important it is and what was happening. And I agreed with her. She said, can you raise $100,000? Oh, yeah. I said, don't worry about that. It's a piece of cake. So we will raise $100,000 the way we're going.
Do you ever get concerned about succession planning as far as fundraising in this community? Whether we have the people in place who've been educated to do the ask?
Yeah. People give to whom they want to give to, number one. Okay. Number two, I don't think that anything's going to change because of the generosity of the people in this town. They've been like that for years. I think that will continue. So I don't think the fundraising people need to fear. As long as they do due diligence and they do a great presentation, they do their homework, and they have a lot of personality, you'll sell that person.
Mm-hmm. Every community has these people, but... Is there something that our community could do to help create the next leaders, the next people that are going to be asking to help support the community?
What we need is people, young people, to come forward who have the interest and the time to do it. And that's the biggest challenge. It's a challenge for everybody. The churches are having trouble. All the nonprofit clubs are having trouble. Lions, Rotary, Kinsmen, all of them, they're having great trouble trying to get membership. Things are changing quickly, and it's making a huge difference. But it'll come back, and you just have to be persistent.
So I guess the age of technology has allowed people to have a big broadcast in order to try to connect people to different fundraisers or fundraising.
Absolutely.
How important do you think that is today for every organization to really have a strong communication about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and what the impact is going to be?
It's very important. If they don't do that, they're going to disappear. For instance, membership is the key to anything. And I've been telling the clubs as I go around, ask every member to bring in a new one. You know, different things of doing it. But it's very hard because, as I said earlier, the young ones, they don't want to go to church. They don't want to join these. And so it's become a challenge.
So you're, again, you have a tremendous legacy involved in an endless amount of organizations. Can you reflect and think about maybe it's perhaps the work you've done with Rotary, being a district governor, being a major player in Rotary as far as fundraising? What do you think you've drawn from that, giving yourself a global perspective or looking at the projects themselves and just saying, this is something we can tackle, we can take it on because we have the membership?
I've enjoyed satisfaction. I do it because I'm selfish and I get a lot of fun out of it. And that's the main reason that I do it. I don't look for a pat in the back, but it does come along. And it is nice when people do it. But it's just a matter of I want to do and I want to make a difference. I tell people that we all come into the world with absolutely nothing. And if we could leave something behind, then we're going to make the world a better place, change the world, and help those in need, which is true. Mm-hmm. We all come with absolutely nothing. So
it's an essential part of everybody's story, I think.
That's right.
There's a gradual beginning in some cases to really find yourself, but ultimately there's only so many things you can do with money, and one is to spread it around.
Well, I at Rotary 2 weeks ago, I had a young new Rotarian in our club. I won't say his name. I don't have the okay to say it, but he came up to me and he said, I would like to take over polio for the district, do the fundraising. He's bright, he's full of energy, he's very successful in business. Of course, I said, I would be delighted. I said, just come by and talk to me and I'll give you all kinds of ideas, because that's what I'm looking for, somebody to take over for what I do. Mm-hmm. Bob Scott got one of the executives from Rotary International to take over for him, which is a good thing. So you've got to find somebody that's capable, qualified, that really has the heart to do it. And there's lots out there. You just have to find them, and then you're all set.
So what would you say to somebody who is either joining Rotary or joining an organization who wants to get one of these leadership roles? What are the steps they should be doing now?
Well, if once they join Rotary, the Rotary Club will assign them different ones, and they have their choice of what they want to go on to. And that's a great teaching way of getting these people educated and to get them involved and getting them to want to do something. Mm-hmm. And that works quite well.
It's essential to have a mentor. It's essential to be educated in the field that you're going to want to prosper.
I've had a few in my life, but it's all worked out well, and I've enjoyed it.
It's very fascinating. So I'm taking a look at you. I'm looking back at your career. You started humble beginnings. You obviously found your unique skill set by identifying what was potentially inefficient in the business and demonstrating what your value was going to be.
And I ran with it. And I continue to run with it today. And I'm just delighted to be part of it. I'm ecstatic of the help that I get and the support, whether it's in donations for an auction or it's a cash donation or they want to get involved. I've never looked back and I'm never worried because there's always somebody there to help me or bail me out when I'm in trouble.
There are some unique stories. I'm sure you got just, this is the thing with this interview, it's just a mountain of stories and experiences. Is there a story or an experience you'd want to share with people that kind of highlights the value of contributing to the community? So you're obviously have a large amount of experiences. Would you say something along the lines of Marie Dressler Foundation or something like that that really stands out?
The Marie Foundation, I was really glad that Rick Miller has taken over it. My wife and I, along with Dr. Bob Scott, who passed away, and a couple others, and Bob from the golf course, who also passed away, we pulled up in front of it, Bob and I, and we looked at it, and I said, you know, Bob, I'm going to buy it, and we're going to turn it over to the Chamber of Commerce. And I was part of their board. I didn't ask them till that next meeting. I told them what I did. And I said, I'll raise all the money for it. Raised it within a year, and it made them their home. Now, the Marie Dressler building there, we had Mim and Bob in there for many years, but they pulled them out. They redid it all, and it's all slides and things like that now. But we get hundreds and hundreds of people visit every year. So I tell people, every time you add something to the community, whether it's the Marie Dressler or it's the skating rink or the fountain, it's an extra to bring people into town. Mm-hmm. And it's a win-win situation. So we're still part of Marie Dressler, and they're doing very well. And it's a real success story, that one.
It certainly is. I just want to extend my gratitude for everything you've done for this community. I think it's a very valuable position to have somebody who has the strength to take the leadership. Obviously, there's a number of causes that certainly need fundraising previous to now and going forward. I wish you all the success and everything that you're working on. It's very inspiring to hear all of these interesting ideas that you have and then see them worked out.
Well, as I said in the beginning, I enjoyed it. I'm having a great time. And if I can make a difference in someone's life, I'm absolutely delighted. And I really enjoyed myself over these years. And I hope that I'm going to be around for a few more years to continue.
Absolutely. Wish you all the success.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
I would like to extend a special thank you to Bill and Delphine Patchett for welcoming me into their home to record this interview. I would also be remiss if I didn't thank my crack staff, editor, sound technician, and producer, Jeff Kane. For more information about Business Insights with John Racine, please like us on Facebook, visit my website at johnmeansbusiness.com, or you can contact me through email at John, J-O-H-N, at Racine, R-A-C-I-N-E, financial.ca.